Okay, Boker Tov. To move up. All right, it's a pleasure to have Dr. Pelkovitz, who's really a wonderful speaker. I think one of the top people really in the world in terms of dealing with the raising of children, social, all the social issues that are facing our community, abuse issues, and he holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Jewish Education at Yeshiva University. He's a special assistant to President Richard Joel. He has lectured extensively and around the world, has published, and it's really an honor, and we were very honored that you accepted our invitation. And without further ado, Bevakasha.
Thank you so much for the warm introduction and for allowing me to be here. This is a conference that I'm constantly conflicted personally, because I always want to be in the other sessions, but they told me I have to be here, so here I am. Okay. So this topic is in keeping with the theme of the conference. I'm going to focus on what does some of the current research tell us about what's associated with instilling values in our children and our grandchildren and the next generation. And I'm going to focus on, I'll start with three ingredients in terms of where the challenges are, and then we'll make some recommendations and have a discussion between now and 10 o'clock. I'll start with some research that some of you may have heard me discuss before, known as the Affluenza Studies by Dr. Sonia Luther at Columbia University. Dr. Luther took a look at a group of kids from Scarsdale in New York, wealthy kids, wealthy adolescents. And she compared several hundred of these adolescents who had every privilege known to our community. They had money, they had the best education, the best tutors, the best that money could buy. And she compared them to a matched comparison group of poor kids, of kids who came from the other side of the tracks. Not terrible poverty, they had their basic needs met, but kids of lower socioeconomic background. And she expected to show the obvious, that we're going to have much more, much higher functioning in the affluent kids. And it turns out that she found the exact opposite. The affluent kids had triple the rate of depression, triple the rate of anxiety, and a much higher rate of alcohol abuse. And the question is why? And she identified in subsequent studies three operative ingredients. And I'll organize the beginning of my thoughts about those three operative ingredients. Ingredient number one was that these kids came from communities where it was never enough just to be average. Now, when's the last time somebody came to shul on a Shabbos morning and bragged about their kid getting in the 50th percentile on their SAT? We don't brag about that. And because of that, it was hard for these kids to find their uniqueness. So number one was that. Number two in these studies was she found that there was not enough time spent with the kids, even though their parents may have had the luxury of spending more time with them, they tended to outsource their parenting. There were housekeepers, there were tutors, and their parents were often preoccupied. And number three is the kids took and never gave back. In other words, they weren't living in a culture of chesed. There was a sense of magili, a sense of entitlement. And they weren't required, because sure, they do service learning to get into a better college, but that wasn't enough. When you're doing it just to get into college, it doesn't count. So I'm going to use those three ingredients as the springboard for my initial talk here, and then I'm going to go into specific recommendations. Let me start, though. I'm sorry? No. Right, yeah. Let me make that clear. Regular Scarsdale community. My guess is many of them might have been Jewish. I think Scarsdale has a pretty heavy Jewish population, but I, to my knowledge, I don't even remember what her breakdown was. So let me start with the ingredients having to do though with with time. I'll start with that. So the ingredient with time is an important one, because that there's been a shift, and we know there's a direct linear correlation between time that parents and other adults spend with children and their internalization of values. So you may have heard the famous studies done at Columbia by Dr. Califano that every night a week the parents have dinner with their children, there's correspondingly lower risk for drug abuse. Those studies have been somewhat criticized, but for the most part, it holds true that for whatever reason, in any study that looks at the time internalization of values connection, they find a linear correlation. Then the question becomes, given that reality, what is it that is going wrong with that now sometimes in our community? And I don't think anybody here is going to be surprised when you hear that I'm about to focus on this, okay? The idea that on both ends, very often, children are being raised by parents who often are preoccupied, often unconsciously. You know, parents are having dinner with their kids, but even though they're in that category in Dr. Califano's research of having dinner with their kids a number of times a week, or maybe even every night a week, but if while you're doing it, you know, you're doing it while texting and checking your email and taking cell phone calls, it doesn't quite count. You know, 1,000 years ago, Rabbeinu Bachya said a four-word prayer that really captures this. Hashem yatzileni mipizur hanefesh. God save me from fragmentation of my soul. Okay? Hashem yatzileni mipizur hanefesh. That's become the challenge of our time on this ingredient. Okay? Because very often kids will say that, you know, my parents, I just don't have their attention all the time. And the kids themselves are picking up on this modeling and are very much fragmented and complain about being fragmented. Complain about, there's a sea change now, for example, where in the last, I'd say, year and a half to 2 years, more than 50% of American kids say that if they had to choose between texting their best friends and having a face-to-face interaction with their best friend, they prefer to text their best friend. That's a little bit of a scary kind of thing. Listen to this study that came out earlier this year. It's an amazing study. They take a group of adolescent girls, and they do something mildly upsetting to them. Okay, whatever the ethics of this are isn't for now. But they then randomly assign them to two groups. Half are randomly assigned to call their mothers for comfort. The other half are assigned to text their mothers for comfort. They then measure the physiologic correlates of stress in response to the mother's comfort via text or via her voice. And it turns out that when it's the mother's voice on the phone call, there's real soothing that takes place. The kids really show lower levels of cortisol. I mean, a shift in every measure of stress. The girls, clearly, their mother's calming and soothing words and voice chills them out. The texting, even though it may be the same words, has absolutely no impact on their stress levels. And what we're finding, that as communication in this next generation shifts from voice to text, let alone face-to-face interaction, which of course is the highest level, we're finding that what's happening is that the empathy levels of this generation in some recent research seems to have gone down. And that obviously is going to have impact on internalization of values, and there's tremendously new body of research, especially in some longitudinal research done by Dr. Christian Smith, who has a wonderful data set of adolescents who he's followed intensively in terms of moral development and religious development into young adulthood, and he finds a very alarming drop in their ability to even think in moral terms. moral reasoning. When he poses moral dilemmas to them, they actually look at him kind of blankly, like, what are you talking about? This whole idea that moral relativism seems to be what's taken over. The other issue in terms of value development on this time issue and in terms of the impact of new technology is first of all, let me tell you about Boston Children's Hospital. About a year and a half ago, Boston Children's started to report that there's now a new phenomenon that they're admitting adolescents for exhaustion. Similar kind of exhaustion that you see usually in combat soldiers who come from months of ongoing combat, or certainly weeks of ongoing combat without rest and without sleep. So try to figure out, what's this about? These are adolescents. They're just going through regular life. Turns out it's tied to a phenomenon they call the on-call syndrome. Here's the on-call syndrome. The kids, everybody, my guess is if I asked you by a show of hands, how many of you sleep with your cell phone next to your, on your nightstand? Probably most people. I do. Okay. That's not abnormal. I do it, right? So I used to have a professor who would say there are two kinds of people. There are normal people and there are people I know, you know? Once you get to know anybody, you sort of see the reality. But anyway, why were these kids different? Because they were sleeping with their cell phone under their pillow. And they'd often be texted dozens and dozens of times a night with extremely important texts like, what's up? Or how you doing? And because of this mode of sleeping, they were always nervous. What is it they call? FOMO now. You all know about FOMO, F-O-M-O, fear of missing out. Okay? The biggest fear of any adolescent. So because of FOMO, these kids would literally not go into REM sleep. And ultimately, you can't survive without REM sleep. And ultimately, it led to their hospitalizations in Boston Children's. So those are some of the phenomena that are happening on that end. But then the more alarming one on this first of the three ingredients is the reality that the nature of social connection when you're primarily relying on texting or even on email is the online disinhibition effect. When you don't see somebody face-to-face, you by nature tend to be more cruel. You tend to not be aware of your cruelness. You tend to feel somewhat anonymous, and you're not protected by the normal kamayim panim el panim kein lev ha'adam of our hearts bouncing off each other. It says in Mishlei that we have to, in our human interactions, just like our face, and our reflection in the water, we went across the street to the lake and we looked into the water once the sun comes out a little later, you would see your face reflected in the water. So too, it says in Mishlei, our hearts have to bounce off each other. But that could only be through the visual cortex. As I just said in that earlier study, it could only be through the visual cortex. There's something called mirror neurons, which in the last decade has been researched quite a bit. You see me talking to you, I'm moving my hand like this. If you had a picture of the motor cortex of my brain, you'd see a dedicated set of motor neurons dedicated to going like this. Not surprising. The surprising new finding is that as I go like this, and each of you is looking at me with your eyes, looking at me, what's happening? You're literally have mirror neurons. And guess what your mirror neurons are doing? Going like this, because we're hardwired for empathy. Why is it that in the Torah it says that Moshe vayar b'sivlosam, the first time he goes out of the protective cocoon of Paro's palace and sees the suffering of his fellow Jews, even though he had heard it in the past, it's only when it's vayar, it's only mirror neuron to mirror neuron that you could really get something. And that seems to be tied to the shift in this area. And the obvious take-home message is just recognition. In California, Debbie Fox did an incredible study. She looked at a large group of adolescents going to the modern Orthodox high schools there. And one of the brilliant questions she asked there was when you're old enough to have your own children and your own teenagers at home, how will you handle the internet differently than your parents handle it with you? Do you know that more than half the kids said, I'll be a lot stricter? If I could only get those images out of my head that I should never have seen, I can never get those images out of my head. If I could only get the time back that I lost, I can never get that time back I lost, being up to 2, 3 in the morning, wasting my time, you know, being online or texting. So in terms of that first ingredient, the first ingredient is to the challenge of our age is how to take this, which is an incredibly wonderful, wonderful medium. And I could go on and on about the good of all this stuff. You know, I'll just end this with a Kutzker, and a thought that I heard in the name of Rav Asher Weiss. It talks about a Gemara that says, it's talking about how do we refer to the Har HaBayis, which is really the place where everything comes from, where we absorb all of our learning from. The Har HaBayis, the source of the Torah and the source of our religion. So there are three ways it's looked at, right? It's looked at as a field, it's looked at as a mountain, or it's looked at like a house. So Abraham, what is it with Abraham? Abraham, it's looked at as Har HaBayis, right? Yitzchak, it's a sada, it's a field. And Yaakov, it's a house. And the Gemara concludes, we have to view it as a house. So Rav Asher Weiss says, why? Why give the preference to Yaakov's, to the imagery, to the metaphor of a house? He says, you know why? Because in relating to the Torah, and relating to the outside world, a house has windows and a house has doors. We need sometimes to let the outside world in, but you also sometimes need to shut it out. And that's the challenge. In terms of internalizing values, is how to figure out how to do it. And I'll just end this section. Then we could talk about it more realistically as we get closer to the end and to the 10 o'clock start of Rabbi Weil. And that's the magnificent Kutzker. The Kutzker asks, why is it that at the end of Tehillim, when it compares raising children to being an archer, it says, "Kachitzim yagibar kein b'nei anurim," right? So it talks about the educational process as similar to being an archer. So the Kutzker answers, because just like an archer, the closer you hold the bow to your heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes, so too with raising children. The closer we hold them to our heart, the further and straighter we go. But remember, the heart is only with mirror neuron to mirror neuron, carving out some real one-on-one time. And that's what those studies show, and that's part one. Part two. Part two has to do with the component that I was talking about in terms of a new phenomenon, which is the phenomenon of the lack of uniqueness, the lack of uniqueness in our children. And we all know what that's about. More and more our schools are designed to this cookie cutter kind of an approach. And it's, like I said earlier, in the affluenza studies and Dr. Luther's studies, there's a real problem with kids being forced to fit into this little narrow kind of a box. And we have to think about that a little bit in terms of where to go with this. Listen to this. Two thoughts. One is, I heard about a parenting program. I don't remember if it was in California or in Florida, that was given by a world-renowned parenting expert, usually fills up the auditoriums. So the joint PTAs of one of the communities in one of those neighborhoods had this woman come in, who always packs the audience, and they called her parenting talk, Parenting the Average Child. And nobody came. Okay? Now, what does that say about our time? Okay? Last year also, there was a phenomenal article I came across in the New York Times It was about a woman. Her name was Sheila. And she lived a life that was a extremely unremarkable life on the face of it. Totally unremarkable on the face of it. Her life was marked by none of the conventional markers of success. She worked a low-level clerical job. She never married or had children. She was somehow a very simple, basic life, and by the conventional markers, certainly that our neighborhood is sometimes plagued by, she was a very average person. And the newspapers in her area heard that she had a massive funeral. Massive funeral. Now, they weren't ready with crowd control. Many, many, many hundreds of people came, and nobody knew why. But the papers heard about it and felt there has to be a story here. How could this simple woman, Sheila, who seemed to have lived an incredibly unremarkable life, pack people in when normally you would have expected a graveside service for her? It's an amazing story I read about this. So they actually put the word out to the community through the paper. Please let us know, what was it that was so remarkable about this woman? And they got, from what I remember, 100 responses, which they posted on a website. And the 100 responses all pretty much had the same theme. Sheila was a remarkable woman because she was remarkable in her kindness and remarkable in her mindfulness. They all said the same thing. When you talk to Sheila, you were the only person in the room. When you talk to Sheila, she really cared about what you said. And she would do anything to help you out. She was a giant in chesed. And we have to somehow expand our expectations to allow for that uniqueness into our world. Because that's ultimately when children are most likely to internalize our values. That's when it's most likely to happen. Okay, let's move on. Just going to end this uniqueness section with two quotes, okay? One from Rabbeinu Tzadok and one from Rav Kook. Okay, listen to this. Here goes the Rabbeinu Tzadok. Kishem shetzorich adam lahamin ba'ashem yisparach. Kach tzorich achar kach lahamin ba'atzma. Just like a person has to believe in God, so too does he or she have to believe in themselves. Rotza lomar. Sheyesh la'ashem yisparach eitzak imo. God has dealings with us. V'sheinenu po'el batel shebein layla hayo vein layla. And we're not an insignificant being that's here 1 minute and gone the next. But then he goes on to write, listen to this. What's the first tefillah we teach our children? When they're little, our little children, our little grandchildren. Modani, right? You open up your eyes and you say Modani. And there's a whole different interpretation that he gives on the last two words of Modani. How do you end Modani? Rabba emunasecha, which we usually think has to do with our faith in God. Doesn't, he says. He says that Rav Emunusecha, Kach Shehu Mamin Banu, that the first words that we teach our children to have out of their mouth every morning is that God believes in us. Total paradigm shift. Total paradigm shift. And the question is how do we get that across? I'm going to get to that with some specific recommendations. But first I want to talk about a component of the ingredients of talking in general about balance and parenting. Because in affluenza studies, I didn't focus on this before for the sake of trying to keep it tight, but not only are parents in those homes, in those affluent homes, not necessarily spending time with their kids, but part of their not spending time with their kid is that they're not setting limits. It's a tremendous amount of hesitation about finding the balance between love and limits. I'm just going to share with you a story, and with that, I'll end it and go to some specific recommendations, okay? And then we'll have a discussion. Here's the story. Many of us know that there's been a sea change in the balance between love and limits since the early 1900s. I was just learning the Pizesna Rebbe's Chovas HaTalmidim last Shabbos. I was amazed to see that even back there, he wrote that in the 1930s, before his whole community was practically annihilated and he himself was killed by the Nazis. But just before those horrible, horrible years, he wrote about the same thing. So this isn't new. And the research shows that. But every year from 1920 to 1980, though, if you ask the average American parent, what are among the top dreams you have for your children, in the top three or four was raising obedient children. Every year from 1980 on, raising obedient children has fallen further and further down the top 10 list, and it's now no longer on the list. Meaning, the average American parent, and I see this in Australia and in South Africa and different parts of Europe, so it's not just the United States and Canada, it's the Western world. Raising obedient children is no longer a value, and in the balance between love and limits, most parents in today's modern society have become love specialists at the expense of limits. The reality is, all the research shows the same, that you need the middle. All love, no limits, our kids grow up overindulged and spoiled. All limits, no love, they don't internalize our values. Rules without relationships equals rebellion. You have to go for the middle. The art of parenting and the art of instilling values in children is the middle, the balance between love and limits. Psychologists call it authoritative parenting. And it's exactly what the Gemara tells us. The Gemara tells us what's the key to raising children and what's the key to educating children. It's to find the balance between smol gochev imim karevet, the left hand pushing away while the right hand brings closer. Famously, Rabbi Simcha Wasserman, who was the giant in education and parenting in California in the last generation, he famously said, what happens if you put into play what the Talmud told us all those centuries ago, and you literally take a child standing in front of you, you could try this when you get home, or if you have kids here this Shabbos, and you literally push them away with the left hand while bringing them closer with the right hand, what happens? You turn them around. Here's the story. I told this over to some group in Manhattan. And afterwards, a rabbi in the audience, a prominent rabbi, came over to me. And he said, it's so interesting that you're quoting Rav Simcha Wasserman, because I went to his high school in Beverly Hills. He had a Masifta high school, and I went there, and he was exactly like you're saying. He was a master in knowing how to find just right the right balance between love and limits. And then he told me the following story. He said he was about 15 years old. He was living in the dormitory of Rabbi Wasserman's school. He had another roommate. I guess in Beverly Hills dormitories, there's only two kids to a room. That's not what I remember from my dormitory days. But the rule there was the kids had to make their beds every morning. Now, when in the history of man has a 15-year-old boy made his bed in keeping with that rule? It doesn't happen in dormitory yeshivas, and it doesn't happen in our homes so easily. It's usually a battle, and certainly this future rabbi never made his bed, nor did his roommate. One day, after a long day of learning, he comes back to his room, and they want to call the cops because it looked like some kind of perverted person must have broken into their room and made both their beds meticulously, like hospital corners, like professionally. And they don't know how this could have happened. And they're like worried to go into their room. They don't know what's waiting for them. Finally, he screws up his courage. He walks into his room and he sees on his pillow and his roommate's pillow two beautifully handwritten notes, five words on each note. Beds made by Simcha Wasserman. That's all it says. He said Rabbi Wasserman never gave them a dirty look. He never raised an eyebrow at them. But he said, I got news for you. For the rest of our high school career, me and my roommate made our beds every single day. Fine. I tell this story over at a parenting get-together in California about 2 years ago. And afterwards, as I'm about to rush out to catch the red eye back to New York, the principal of the local Beis Yaakov comes over to me. And she says, interesting story. I knew Rabbi Wasserman, and you're 100% correct. That's exactly what he was like. But she says, I have something for you to think about on the plane. I have something for you to think about. She said, if the same story happened today, okay, this is, let's say, 2011, she said, would those boys have made their bed for the rest of their high school career? It sort of hit me. And I'm thinking about it on the plane, and I'm thinking about it and thinking about it. And luckily, that Wednesday night in New York, there was a school, a modern Orthodox high school in the New York metropolitan area that had mandatory parenting nights. This one was on substance abuse prevention, and I was asked to be the speaker. You had to go. Reminds me, once my youngest daughter went to Yeshiva University High School for Girls, Central High School, and there they had three mandatory parenting nights where you had to go to parenting lectures if you wanted to re-enroll your child in the high school the next year. So they figure I'm a parent in the school. They had a freebie with me, so they asked me to give the three. So I go and I give the first. And 2 days later in the mail, I get the following letter. Dear Dr. and Mrs. Pelkovitz, this is to tell you that you missed a very informative lecture by Dr. David Pelkovitz. The next two lectures given by Dr. Pelkovitz will be, and they give the date, and you will not be allowed to enroll Ronit in the school next year if you don't show up. So I called the head of the school. I said, how did you know I wasn't paying attention? You know? Right? I wasn't listening to a word. So anyway, so I'm about to give the talk in this high school, in this yeshiva high school, and I opened it by telling them the story of Rabbi Wasserman in the beds, and I said, there were about 400 people there. It was mandatory. I said, how many of you think your children would have made your bed for the rest of your their high school career? Two people raised their hand. So I thought maybe they're not listening, maybe they don't get it. I said, how many of you think that your children, this would have no impact on your children whatsoever? And 398 hands go up. The rest of the room, everybody raises their hand. It's a change. If we want our kids to internalize values, we have to understand that I think we have, the reality is we have to lead with our right hand. We have to lead with the Yemin Makarevas. But as we lead with our right hand, we have to understand that that there's, parents need help in learning how to be comfortable with their kid being upset. Very often kids come back from their year of study in Israel and they're extremely upset with the fact that their parents let them do as much as they did in high school. It's a new phenomenon. Kids coming back from Israel furious. How did you let me go on a Saturday night to that on that trip to Manhattan when you knew that I was going to use fake ID to get into that bar? How did you allow me to have a free house when you were off at that weekend bar mitzvah and you knew that that I was going to invite everybody over? And kids are constantly saying now that they're going to be a little more strict. I don't know if they will. We're already probably in the second generation of this kind of parenting, if not the third, certainly on the second, and it's not that easy. And I'll just end this with a very basic kind of Jewish insight. It says in Mishlei, Yaser bincha ki yesh tikva vel hamiso al titei nafshecha, put limits on your children, there's always hope, and don't pay attention to their screaming and yelling. And the Medrash on this pasuk says, Kol ha-mosif av yisurin al beno, mosif ha-ben ahava al aviv. The more a father puts limits on his child, the more that child will love the parents. And that's what I'm beginning to see. You have to figure out how to do that, but that's, I think, one of the challenges of our generation in terms of helping children, helping bring in the internalization of values. Okay. That's the end of the main part of the talk. Now I want to talk about two more issues. The first is invisible modeling. The ways that we unconsciously transmit values to our children, right hemisphere stuff. We all know moral knowledge and moral action are two completely different things. the guy who teaches, the famous child psychiatrist, Dr. Coles, who taught three sequential courses in moral development at Harvard, talks in one of his books on this area about how one of his leading students dropped out of Harvard after taking the third course with him because she said that she was the first person from her very poor town to go off to college. The town saw her off with the parade, but she didn't get a full scholarship, and she had to work very, very hard to make it through Harvard. And she took the three courses with him, but she told him the person who was ranked number one in all three classes, she used to have to go and clean his apartment off campus. He was a very, very wealthy guy from a very prominent family. And he and his friends would purposely degrade her in her cleaning duties, just sort of to stick it to her that she had to do this. And as she says goodbye to Dr. Coles to go off to some much less prestigious university, she says, any institution that has such a disconnect between moral knowledge and moral action, I don't want to be a part of. Very sad, and we all know that's true. We all know it's true. We all know people who it's not tohu kaboru, who don't internalize our values. It's interesting. In the research on moral development, they find that, you know what one of the most powerful sites is of moral education of our children? It's how we talk about people we disagree with around the Shabbos table. I don't mean literally the Shabbos table, but Friday night, Shabbos lunch. As we're talking about, it could be politicians we disagree with, it could be people in shul or in the community who we disagree with, our kids are listening to that. And kids who come from families where respect is shown even to people we disagree with, doesn't mean we can't disagree, but we disagree in a respectful way that shows respect for what could they be thinking and shows respect for their right to disagree, that becomes an incredibly important ingredient. You know, the Kutzker says, he says, why is it? We just lamed Pinchas a couple of weeks ago, right? No, last week. Yeah, okay. We just lamed Pinchas, okay. And I had a whole Dvar Torah prepared for you this whole Shabbos on Pinchas. I'll have to get a new one. Okay. So we just lamed Pinchas, and there's the famous Medrash on Hashem Elokei Aruchos, that says, Kashem Shem Parzifot Sayin Shava, Kachin Deus Sayin Shava. Moshe is very worried about his successor. And he's crying out to God, how am I going to find, how is there going to be a leader for the Jewish people? There are 600,000 different faces, Parzufin, and 600,000 different perspectives. And the Kutzker says, brilliantly, he says, why is it that the analogy here is to a Parzif, to a face? It's a strange analogy. Of all the analogies, why is that the comparison? So the Kutzker says this is why. When you're walking down the street and you see somebody who looks at you, whose face looks differently than yours, do you get angry? If I'm walking down the street and I see you, I say, hey, you have hair, I don't have hair. You know, you're younger. You know, whatever it is, I don't get angry at somebody who looks differently than me. Assuming, you know, you walk down the street, everybody looks different. You were watching the parade yesterday, you saw all kinds of different partsufen. I doubt that anybody got angry at somebody who looked differently than they did. It's just not human nature. He says, that's the goal. The goal is, of course people have different perspectives. No two people have the same perspectives. That's what makes life so interesting. And that's what we have to look for. We have to be very careful about how we present the perspective of others. And we subtly show to our children how much we appreciate their uniqueness or don't accept their uniqueness through that invisible modeling as well. Many of you may remember one of the classic studies in educational psychology about Clever Hans, the genius horse in math. Remember? There's a genius horse in math, a German farm in the late 1800s. Turns out there's a horse. You could ask this horse any math question. This isn't a study. It's actually more of just a part of the lore of psychology in the early years of psychology. It's a fascinating, fascinating kind of way of thinking. So there's this horse. You could ask it the most complicated math question. If the answer was 293, Hans would tap out 293 and stop. If the answer was 10, he would tap out 10 and stop. Amazing. people were overrunning the farm from all over Europe because it's an amazing thing to see. You couldn't get Hans out. So a psychologist of the time heard about this, and he goes to the farmer. He says, look, we're going to have to totally rethink our understanding of human versus animal intelligence. Can I please hang out with your horse for a little while? And the farmer said, please, I'm not making any money off this. If you could figure out what this is about, I need to get my farm back. It's overrun with tourists. So the psychologist starts testing clever Hans, can't get him out. This is one genius horse. Until he breaks the code. He puts a screen up between him and the horse. And now clever Hans becomes totally unable to get a single answer right. Because what's he a genius at? Not a math. We all know horses can't do math. He's a genius at reading nonverbal cues. So the answer was 85. At 85, the questioner's pupils would subtly dilate. There'd be a little bit of a raise in an eyebrow. Breathing pace would shift. Color of skin would shift a little bit. And that's what Hans was a genius at, as many horses are, at reading the nonverbal. And that happens with us and our children also. We have to remember that as we fan the flames of our children's uniqueness through invisible communication, that's the best way to have them internalize our values. Listen to this. And maybe with this, I'll move on to the final point. Unless I should just end with this. Maybe I'll end with the story so we'll have some time for discussion. Okay. Listen to two Rav Cooks I want to end with. Sarashav kol ish yeda v'yavin. Every person needs to know. Shebetoch tocho dolek ner. The ein neiro shelo kener chaver. Everybody needs to know that burning inside them and burning inside all of our children is a fire. And no two fires are the same. No two. By the way, the key to kids internalizing our values is we have to teach to their unique fire. Because that's when they more fully internalize our values. The research shows this. You don't. If you have six kids or four kids or two kids, you don't use exactly the same parenting strategies with each kid. Each kid needs their own parenting strategy. As the Kutzker said, there's nothing as unequal as the equal treatment of children. I'll say that one more time. There is nothing as unequal as the equal treatment of children. The Einish Shel Ein Lo Ner. There isn't a single person who doesn't have a candle. The Tsar Shekol Ishyed of Yavin, Shal of Lamol Ulgalos, Esar Haner Burabim. We also have to help our children learn that they have to share their unique abilities and skills with everybody else. Ulahadliko lavuka gadola, ulahair esa olam kulo. And to literally, through that, to light a huge bonfire that will set the world ablaze. Let me end with a story, okay? Because I can't possibly do everything that I, you know, always happens to me. But I made my main points. Let me summarize what I've said, and then we'll end with the story. So what I've said until now was, in terms of internalization of values, that we have to look at some of these core ingredients that are so important in terms of parenting our children, parenting our grandchildren, or being educators of the next generation. One of it is time, true presence, really being there as role models, and figuring out a way to give our kids at least a little bit, some kind of undivided attention, because moral development is what they see us do and how they see us value others. And that could only be done through the currency of time. I heard from the best friend of one of the sons of Rav Bloch, who was the head of the Tells Yeshiva in Cleveland at the beginning of their existence here in this country. He said his father, who was extremely busy, would start every day, 6 o'clock in the morning, would knock on his door. He'd be in his bathrobe. His son would be in pajamas. He'd sit down at the kitchen table and have a glass of tea and milk with his son. Talk about the day to come for his son. Talk about his day to come and hear about the previous day. Just think about what a message that is to children and what that does in terms of internalization of values. So that's that ingredient. The other ingredient is the ingredient of finding the balance between love and limits, the story about beds made by Simcha Wasserman, but it's an art. We need to find, it's like being a cook. You know, recipes differ based on our kids' temperament and based on our styles and based on our ability to be able to figure out what works for each of our kids. And similarly, to find the uniqueness to light the unique candle of each child. Let me end with a story, unless you'd rather have questions for the last 15 minutes. How would you prefer? Story? I will still have questions. It'll be a brief story. Brief story. Okay. Brief story. Okay. Okay. I have about 5 stories in my head. But let me end with an expectation story. How many of you have heard my story about the bracha and the boy in the pool hall? Probably not so many people. Okay, good. Looks like nobody. Good. Okay. I always pray for audiences that don't listen. My father was installed as the rabbi of the Weitschel some 62 years ago. My grandfather was a rabbi in Connecticut, and he was asked to do the installation of my father in his new job. And I remember growing up, my grandfather evidently gave an incredibly memorable speech. And his parting words to the audience of the congregants of the Weitschel was, please be kind to my son. But then he looked at my father and he said, my blessing to you is that you should have congregants who have very short memories. Okay? Okay. So that's what you always hope for. So you could use the same material over again. Okay, here's the story. There was a there was a conference similar to this, but this was for parents of children who have left our way of life. So it was a conference, a weekend conference in a hotel, and it was parents, all of whom pretty much had, what they had in common was that their children were no longer actively observant. They came to get mutual support and to talk about strategies to get their kids back. And there was a fascinating panel Friday night. Listen, Friday night they have these kids. They have young adults who had grown up observant and lost everything. They just rejected everything. And the panel was, the kids talked about what led to my alienation. It was amazing because each one was a different story, but it had the same underlying theme. It was about somehow their uniqueness wasn't captured. So one kid said, I was sexually abused, and nobody knew about it, and this young woman said, I just felt damaged and dirty, and I never told anybody, and then I found solace with equally marginalized and damaged-seeming peers. Another kid talked about an undiagnosed reading disability that made him feel dumb throughout his early years, so he felt really dumb. And another kid talked about coming from a family whose passion was that the key to success was Ivy League or die, okay? And he had an attention deficit. So the speaker that night was Rabbi Brafman, the principal of the Yeshiva Far Rockaway. And he got up and he said, you know, I noticed that as parents were benching their children, I don't know how many of you have that minhag of benching your children, grandchildren on a Friday night, a beautiful, beautiful custom. So he said that as they were benching their children, he noticed that each child related to his father or her father and mother in a somewhat different way, totally different way. And he says, you know something? He says, I don't have any easy answers for this, but after hearing that panel, capture the uniqueness of your relationship with your child on that holy moment on Friday night and bottle it and take it to appreciating their unique spark throughout the week. I found that very powerful, but I didn't know what he was talking about. So the next week, I was home, and I start benching my children, my 4 children, who were still home then, and I noticed that each one related to me in a totally different way. My older son, who's taller than me, is this kind of macho kind of guy, but very warm, so his warmth came through, and then my next daughter, her chen, came through, and the daughter after that is just very funny. Her humor came through. My youngest daughter is the cuddly one. She really cuddles into me when I bench her, and into my wife when she benches her also. Okay? So that was the bottom line. I found that fascinating, and I told this story over to a group of psychologists at a Sunday morning program in Brooklyn. And afterwards, the psychologist came to me. He said, I have to tell you about a session that I had just this morning before I came to hear you talk. He said, there's a kid he was seeing, about 16 years old, who's very rebellious. But he's not quite fully gone, but he's on the edge of risk, on the edge of really leaving his background. And he said, the kid came to see him that morning. He says, Doc, I got to tell you a story. He said, last night, I was walking down the streets of Flatbush, and I passed by a pool hall where there's a group there of guys who's the group I've been dying to get into. And I couldn't believe my luck. The head of the group sees me walking by, and he calls me in and invites me. He says, this has been my dream for the last 2 years, to become part of this group. And I was on top of the world. I'm sitting with this group of guys. They're a couple of years older than me, and they're exactly what I want to be. This group of delinquent kids. And he said, after a couple of hours, the head guy must have trusted me, probably wanted to test me a little bit. He sort of casually takes out of his pocket a designer drug. And he said, as he was offering me the drug, he said, totally involuntarily, what comes flashing in my mind was the look of love in my father's eyes when he benched me the night before. And I thought, my father knows I'm better than this. And he said, without even thinking, I took the drug, I push it back into the guy's hand, and I run out. And he says, Doc, he says, I'm taking a solemn shvua. I will never go back in that pool hall again. It's a mustyukna moment, right? It's exactly like the story of Yosef internalizing his father's expectations to stop himself from being involved with the wife of his benefactor. And that's the message I want to leave you with. I think ultimately we talk about, I didn't go into some of the new research on neuroethics, but which is fascinating. But even there, the bottom line take-home message is about these ingredients. It's about the ingredients of time, appreciating uniqueness, figuring out a way to have the courage to have balance. And may we all be zoche to, to realize what I know is our greatest dream, which is to raise children who internalize our best vision of values and of a life where they turn into good, decent, valuable human beings who reflect the values we've educated them with. Okay, I think I'm done, huh?
Yeah, we'll take a few minutes for questions. So if anybody has questions, then Rabbi Weidel.
Yes, please. Yeah, such an interesting question, is because we're probably a relatively rare culture that we send our kids off during adolescence. I myself went to that kind of school, and it's actually, I think, the first time I've been asked that question. It's an excellent question. It's such an important question. So there, I think that in some ways it might be helpful because you're outsourcing your adolescent rebellion to people outside of the house. And it could, and I'm not saying that cynically, actually. I'm saying that it allows you the luxury of really focusing on the positive and focusing on the Amin Makarevis. In other words, I would think. In other words, because the opportunity is you're not seeing your child nearly as much as you would otherwise. There's probably less tension because of that. And as a result, I would use the time that he's home, that it's he, not she, right? Because in Europe, it's she's also. They go off at about 15, 16 to seminary. But to use that time for discussions. I think there's nothing quite as important as occasionally having moral discussions. That's what I was going to talk about with the neuroethics, is that all the research is showing is that if we don't get mindful about values education and giving voice to values, what takes over in ethical situations is the part of the brain that's more emotional and more into self-service, and our moral judgment gets clouded. And the luxury of having the child only home less frequently is that it probably can help cement the relationship in a way that you could have those kind of discussions, what-if discussions. Or, you know, if you could get a real discussion going about some of the temptations in the dorm. Or, you know, what are you comfortable with? There's a book that came out of Harvard called Giving Voice to Values that talks about having some of these what-if conversations. But in general, does that sound at all doable? Or it probably very much varies with the kid's temperament, yeah? Okay, good. Thank you. Excellent question. Yes. Thank you.
My frustration as a therapist is that if you do this kind of stuff, it's the community that kids live in who will not accept it.
Yeah. Sure, sure. So the question is, I hate reality. Reality always gets in the way of my lofty ideas, you know? you could do this all you want. And then what happens is there's a community that is filled with kids that you know, again, the FOMO, fear of missing out. There's nothing, the number one fear really, I think, of any adolescent is not wanting to stick out. And that becomes extremely important. So look, again, I would talk about it, and ultimately we don't have control over it, but I'll just tell you one thing. In the research, the longitudinal research, where you look at a group of young adults and you look at their religious and spiritual levels when they were younger, okay, what you'll find is that what predicts their continuing to show those values as young adults is three ingredients. And probably the most important of the three ingredients is the ability to come from a family. It's really what's happening then. So it's true, in the short term, there are going to be temptations. Your kids will make mistakes, and they'll probably be pulled into the culture of their friends. And all you could do is your best to be a voice of ethics and a voice of values and a voice of supporting them when they don't fit in. But over the long run, when you think about long-term development, okay, and long-term confidence, what you pour into them may not be obvious now, but it will very likely be later on. Now, I know you're talking about, then how do you protect your child from the cruelty of others? And that's the talk in itself, and that's the bullying talk, and, that requires, yeah?
I wasn't talking about the peer group. I was talking about the parents of the...
Oh, I see. So you're talking about the adults. So then the question is, can you become an agent of social change? Is there a way to partner, you know, to get school, shul, home partnerships to make parents more aware of that? You know, I alluded to two schools in the New York City area that mandate parent training. I think you can't change a culture, but you know, as a therapist, you know the transactional theory of change, to go from pre-contemplation to contemplation, to get people to the point that they're thinking about change, requires effort. It's not going to happen on its own. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for a wonderful presentation. We'll now introduce Rabbi Weil, Steve Weil, who is the Executive Vice President of the OU, coming to the OU after a very successful career as a conflict rabbi in Detroit and L.A. And he grew up near us in Toronto on a farm in upstate New York. He's here with his wife and a couple of their seven children, and it's really an honor and a pleasure to have Rabbi Weil for the weekend. Rosh Hashanah.
Good morning, everyone. It's an honor to be here. I want to thank Rabbi Kelman, to Lonnie, and to Dr. David Pelkovitz. It's an honor to be with you. You know, in the old days before cell phones, remember they said if you had one dime, who would you call? Then it became one quarter. So I would tell you this, as a former pulpit rabbi, when a rabbi has one diamond, who do you call? It's always Dr. Palkovitz. We all hawked him day and night. What we're going to talk about first and foremost is something that actually Dr. Palkovitz was involved in. We did a study and a survey of 5,200 Orthodox Jewish men and women on the quality and really the state of affairs of marriage within our community. And what came out of this was fascinating. The initial survey was run by Debbie Fox and by Dr. Palkovitz. And it had a group from Los Angeles, from Orthodox Jews from the West Coast, all different backgrounds, Persian, Syrian, from birth, Bali Tshuva, modern Orthodox, Yeshivish, Hasidish. And you could demarcate what, not only where you were at in terms of the duration of your marriage, whether you were divorced or whether you were married, how old you were. You also could demarcate what your background was, what part of the community you were in. And then what we did was we expanded it, refined it, and added another 3,500. So over a three-year period, you had 5,200 people responding to this survey. Dr. Eliezer Schnall of Yeshiva University, who was part of Dr. Palkovitz's team, he actually presented this to the Eastern Association of Psychiatrists in terms of it being a scientific study and its value to the greater society. So the first half of what we're going to speak about this morning is what we can learn from the state of affairs, so to speak, in our community, in our world. We'll go into some details afterwards in the second half. Let me start out with the good news. The good news I want to say is this. 74% of men and 72% of women, they rated their marriage very good or excellent. Now, why is that significant? Would I love to come here and tell you that this study of Orthodox Jews of all different backgrounds, we came 99%, our marriages are wonderful? I'm sure I'd love to be able to tell you that. But the reality is, the same question when asked of the greater population in society, 62% of men and 59.5% of women rate their marriage, same question, very good or excellent. That's very significant. Literally, we're off the charts in that area. That's the positive. 80% of those, and I'm not referring to the divorcees, of those married, 80% said, if I could do it all over again, I would marry the very same person. Again, very good results. Hey, many of you drove 5, 8, 10 hours to get up to Lake Placid. You don't want a speaker to get up and tell you the good news. We're Jews. I mean, I don't know if you heard, everything that's going on in Egypt this week with Morsi being under house arrest, right, with the judiciary taking over, the military coup, what you've been happening with the markets have been topsy-turvy over the fact that rates are going to go up and the Fed's going to change policy. Did you hear what happened in Israel this week? Did you hear? They discovered a dinosaur. You know what they named the dinosaur? A Brontosaurus, because we love the Tsaurus. So that's why I'm here, is to share the Tsaurus. Now, the methodology that we're going to use this morning in looking at what were issues that are problems in terms of our marriages, our community, our society. We're going to use, and we're going to quote many Ma'amari Chazal and many great rabbis, but to top it off, we're going to start out with one of the great Achronim, David Letterman. We're going to use his methodology. You know how he goes on late night TV from 10 to 9 to 8? So there were six factors that were factors of significance. What does that mean, a factor of significance? 15% or more said this is a problem in our marriage. This is a challenge in our marriage. Now, what's interesting and what's fascinating about this is that in this survey, the very factors that broke marriages, that the divorcees said broke their marriages, those are the very same factors in the majority of the population that people set up problems, our issues, our challenges in our marriages. Interesting. So let's start with six and we'll work our way up. The sixth issue was religious differences. Religious differences. Now, you and I know a human being is not fixed. We're not rigid. A couple gets married in their 20s or their 30s, or let's say it's a late marriage or a second marriage in their 40s or 50s. Over the duration of a 20-year marriage, over the duration of a 60-year marriage, we are not rigid, we're not fixed, we emerge, we develop. And we can either grow and develop together, or very often we grow apart. I put my energy, my time into my career. You put your energy and time into your career or into communal activities. And we're not growing together. We're growing in different directions. What happens? What is Shabbos going to look like in our home? How are we going to dress? Are we going to, you know, those who are sports fans, are we going to have the TV on a time clock? What's kashrus like? You know, will we eat out the way we keep our home? If we eat out, what restaurants, etc.? Dress. What's the definition of modesty? How are we going to dress? How are we going to dress on vacations? Where are we going to go on vacation? We're going to go on vacations where there's no minyan on Shabbos. All these kind of issues that come up. Going to minyan, learning, being kovei eating. So these become significant issues. Where they really become significant issues is when you have adolescent children. Dr. Pelkovitz before referred to the fact that, you know, he's follically challenged. Well, I got to tell you, it's not a function of his, I know the doctors here will say it's a function of his genetics. It's not so. That's a function of adolescent children. Totally a function of adolescent children. Okay. So the only difference between the two of us is, you know, I fake it with Grecian formula. So, but the gray hair, believe me. Now, what's the point? An adolescent child, they can take a little bit of daylight and they can drive a wedge through it and they can split that open. Because if mom allows me to do this but dad doesn't, or if dad, he'll allow me to do it, you know, but mom won't, so you play one off the other. No one can do that like an adolescent child. They can find the hypocrisies, or they can find it may not be hypocrisy. It may just be a distinction. And it becomes a real issue. And a real strain in the marriage. What was interesting is there's one subculture of this population that the 5,200 that were surveyed. Balei tshuva. Religious differences became much more significant in their marriages. Because you can imagine, when they got married, you know, and let's say he's running way ahead, he's going at 70 miles an hour towards religion, she's going at 15 miles an hour, or vice versa. Whether it's mikvah, you know, having an impact on their sexual relationship, whether it's Shabbos, having an impact on their social relationship, on their whole ability to function, becomes an issue. It was a more significant issue in that subcategory. But across the board, religious differences was 15% said it was an issue, a challenge in their marriage. Number five, more than religious differences, was issues associated with intimacy. And what was fascinating here is particularly the subjective component that the women wrote in. See, everyone will tell you the famous Gemara Nida of Rebbe Meir on Lamed Aleph. The whole idea that there's this forced abstinence, what we call Taras HaMishpacha, it sets up a dynamism, an excitement, a rendezvous. So the forced abstinence keeps the marriage fresh and alive. Everyone will quote that. And I'll tell you who's made that famous. It's Dr. Ruth Westheimer. I have never had a very good relationship with her. I can tell you, you put her, that small little German Jewish lady, you put her in a room with 50 men, and I'll take her over the 50 men anytime, any day. I've seen her at work. She's a fascinating woman. So what happens? She and others have taken Rebbe Meir and the whole concept of Taras HaMishpacha. First and foremost, they employed it as sex therapists. But what she shared with me is that today, mainstream family therapists use this as a tool in terms of marriages that are stale, that are challenged, etc. But there's one mistake we make. We all can quote Rebbe Meir, the notion that the abstinence is a means to an end. But we skip over a whole series of the great medieval Rishonim, the Monei HaMitzvos. They deal with it, and they're not contradicting Rebbe Meir. Okay? They're complimenting Rebbe Meir. And they see the period of abstinence as an end in itself, not just as a means to an end. What do I mean by that? And we'll see how it related to the survey. You have a situation where, to use an analogy, take Shabbos. It's mukdash. It's designated or consecrated for a time of spiritual, a time of intellectual growth. Shabbos is designated for a time of family bonding. All the issues that Dr. Pelkovitz was speaking about, you know, Shabbos, if anything, is an island in time where a family actually dialogues, communicates, has a meal together, etc. not addicted to the technology. We know this with Yom Tov. In an ideal form, when the whole nation becomes a nation, once again, comes to Yerushalayim. When those farmers from the Galilee, or the fishermen up on the Mediterranean coast who don't have the best education, they get exposed to the great Talmidei Chachamim. When poor and wealthy come together, we're all one people, one nation in Yerushalayim. We're all guests. So it has Shemitah. Shemitah is a sabbatical. It's a time to recharge one's batteries, to develop oneself intellectually, etc., spiritually. So we all know in Judaism there are many, many halachic institutions that are designated for a certain objective. These Monei HaMitzvos, these great medievalists, say the same thing with Taras HaMishpacha. Meaning what? Why did the two of us choose to get married? Well, there's obviously some kind of psychological, emotional way that we complement each other. There's obviously an intellectual dynamic that we stimulate each other intellectually. Of course there's a chemical attraction that complements the intellectual, the emotional. What was the purpose, they say, of forced abstinence? There's a time that's designated or consecrated each and every month for what? For having the conversations that we had. How do we want to raise our children? How do we want to contribute to the community? For complementing each other emotionally. And there's no carrot at the end of the stick. I mean, I'll give you an example. The reason that he's filling up her car on a cold January night, filling it up with gas, is not because this is the beginning of foreplay, because he wants to put her psychologically in a certain predisposition. No. The reason he is doing this, strictly, there's no alternative motive. It's not because they're going to go upstairs at the end of the night. It's taking a time of the month and designating it to continue that intellectual bond, that emotional bond, etc. What did the women write in here? Many of the women said, I feel like an object, not like a subject. When I'm good for something, he's home. He's home earlier. There's more conversation at the table. But this time of month, so in the case of the guys who are doing their fantasy football and baseball, you know, they're watching SportsCenter, working the statistics. Some guys are staying later in the Beis HaMedrash. Others are staying later at work. Others are sitting there watching, you know, the old Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, the late night movie on TNT. But the point is, because there's not going to be something later on in the evening, we're not going to be going upstairs, or if we are, it's going to be separate beds. You know, so there's less dialogue. And women, many of them said, you know, I feel like an object, not like a subject. So this was one area. There were others that are reflected in the fifth issue, that intimacy and sexual issues are a challenge in our community. More than religious differences, more than issues associated with intimacy or sexual issues. Number four was, and you probably don't need this conference to guess this one, was the issue of boundaries. To say it differently, in-laws. Many of you have heard the famous line, what's the difference between outlaws and in-laws? Outlaws are wanted. What's the point? If I could use an analogy, I'll use an analogy. Take the solar system. The nucleus is the sun, correct? And then you have concentric circles. You have different planets orbiting around the sun. So use that mashal. What's the nimshal? A husband, wife, and their dependent children are the nucleus. Concentric circle are parents. Next concentric circle, the next planet is siblings. Our local Jewish community. Our shul community. Our day school community. Klal Yisrael. Humanity. That's a healthy nimshal in terms of our own personal solar system. Could you imagine the following? Instead of a nucleus, you have nuclei. Boom. Colliding with each other. There's not one center. But there's what? There's this tug between parents or the in-laws and the couple. Now, it's not so simple. Nishta zoi pashut, as we say. Why? Let's look at our community. Well, before we get there, I apologize. Let me add, just develop this for another minute. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the son-in-law of the great Rosh Hashiva of the Gush, the Rav's son-in-law, he said the following. You know, in many of us know this. If you, those of you who have a Medrash Rabbah at home, you'll know the following. That of all of the Midrashim that we have on Chumash and the Chamesh Megillos and the Medrash Rabbah, the largest area of Midrashic material is the first few prakim of Sefer Bereishis. Why is that? Because Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, are not just a couple. What the Almighty was doing is was setting up a paradigmatic relationship. And what Chazal, the Torah Shebaal Peh, is doing is it's setting up certain existential paradigms in terms of the nature of the human condition, the nature of a relationship, etc. So we have the famous verse in terms of that relationship. Al kein yazov ish es aviv v'imo v'davak v'ishto. Literally, therefore shall a man, here it doesn't mean just a man, it could mean a woman as well, therefore shall a person separate from one's parents and cling to one's spouse. Now if you look, you work with the Ramban's definition of davak v'ishto. The primary emotional commitment, halachically, what the Almighty was setting up, is to one's spouse. What you and I refer to in English is cutting the cord, setting boundaries. That's not so simple for us to cut cords and set boundaries. And let me explain to you why it's not so simple. I'm not saying anything that's new or insightful. We want our children to be developed, sophisticated Jews. We want our children to have a chance to live in economically, specifically post-2008, but it was true before 2008, to function and to live in a world where they can function. They can live in the kind of community they'd like to live in, or the kind of community that we live in. But there's an orthodox tax. First and foremost, it's our children's education. There's a blog out there from a couple in Bergenfield, New Jersey. The name of the blog is called 200K Chump. What is 200K Chump? Here they're making in the fourth percentile of all Americans. They live in a little Schwacha house in Bergenfield, New Jersey. They're paying real estate taxes through the nose. They've got four kids in yeshiva tuition, $80,000 post-tax. How are they going to function? They're not driving a new Honda Odyssey every 3 years, a new lease. They're an old beat-up minivan. The house is never, they didn't have the money to fix up the house. Here they are in the fourth percentile of all Americans, and they can't make it. That's the premise of this blog. There's an orthodox tax. I mean, I'll give you an example. The typical American marriage, and I don't know if this is true of Canadian marriage as well, typical average American marriage has about 100 to 120 people at it. A big, huge wedding is 150 people at it. You go to an orthodox wedding, there's less than 400 people there. What, you don't have any friends? What are you, a hermit? There's less than 400. Oh, it must be a destination wedding, because if you got married in your hometown, it would have been 500 or 600 or 700. Tuition. We live in communities. When you look at the houses, what you're paying per square foot relative to any other suburbs, because we have to live amongst each other, live near a mikveh, live near a shul, etc. So what happens? We want these kids, okay, to be able to get a PhD, to get a second degree, to get whatever it's required, whether it's in medicine, whether it's in law. So we want them to do that. That means they're not going to earn substantial income until they're in their late 20s, maybe young 30s. We want them to learn in kollel. We want them to become a Talmud Chacham. Start off their marriage, you know, whatever it is. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, they're married now. They want to be adults. There's a problem being an adult when you're attached to an ATM machine by the name of mom and dad, not Bank of America, or an ATM machine, not by the name of Citibank, but in-laws. So there's an inherent tension, because they're going to fund your education, they're going to subsidize your living, they're going to fund everything you're doing. And they're going to pay for it. They can't have a say in where you live. They can't have a say in how you educate your children. Do you see the inherent tension? And it's not something that we've created per se. Kids want to live near parents. You know, at the OU, we push to go to a Cleveland, to go to a Dallas, a Houston. You've got choices of kosher restaurants, of day schools, of shuls, to go to a Kansas City, to go to places. There's some wonderful, wonderful places. You can live like a mensch. Literally, you could live on 40 to 50% of the revenue that it would require to live an inferior life in the tri-state area or in L.A. or in Toronto or in some of the communities where it costs more. But on the other hand, we know there's a value for children to be raised by grandchildren, by grandparents, not just parents, to be in an environment where the extended family is there. They're close to their extended family. So there's this tension. It has a terrible effect on marriage. But it's not something that we've created. It's something that society inherently, just to survive and function in society, it's an inherent tension. And that's number four. And that's a real challenge. I'll give you an example. They've done studies in the Christian world. A couple gets married. Where are they going to eat Easter Sunday? Where are they going to spend Xmas? With which parents? Thanksgiving dinner? You know, if the two machatunim do not live in the same town, it's not like you can do a home and away series for Siddurim. So you're making a choice. You're going... That shrew, that stinking shrew, you're married 2 months and she's already torn you apart from us because you're going to them. Where are we going to break the fast Yom Kippur? No, we have our own translation of those issues. And it's a real issue, particularly because of the financial. Speaking of the financial, more than religious differences, more than intimacy, sexual issues, more than not being able to set boundaries, issues of not cutting the cord. Number three issue, in more than 20% in our community, is financial stress. What the therapists teach us, and this is a fascinating insight, you know, a human being, figuratively, a human being has the ability to rebound from literally an atomic attack. I mean, you look at families, particularly look at survivors, or look at a family that, God forbid, has either lost a child to cancer or has had a huge, terrible bout with cancer. We have this ability to come back and rebound figuratively. But you know what we can't as human beings do, what we're incapable of? Chronic stress, the therapists teach us. Chronic stress is day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out. That breaks people. And it breaks marriages. I can't tell you. We all know of friends, of fellow communal members, that in a world post-2008, I mean, I have a friend who's a partner at Weil Gotshal. After 2008, in terms of hires, 41% of what, 41% the hires of what they had pre-2008. Talk to Lonnie over at Proskauer Rose. Take Ropes Gray. Take Skadden Arps. You look at the whole notion that a Jewish kid was going to work hard because they had a Gemara cup, he or she, they were going to get into a good, you know, NYU, Columbia, the like, a good law school, and they were guaranteed a job. It's not so. What about Wall Street? I mean, we just had John Liu, the treasurer of New York, in our offices. You know what he shared with me? He says, today, New York City generates more income from tourism than it does from the financial district, from the Wall Street community. The notion that a Jewish boy was going to get a job in a hedge fund or a Jewish girl was going to get a job in an investment banking firm. And it was true. It was a given pre-2008. It's not so anymore. I can tell you, our offices are in the Wall Street neighborhood. We're actually in the process of looking in the Wall Street neighborhood in Jersey City at different facilities. And I go through building after building. And I was expecting to see financial firm, hedge funds, private equity funds. You know what's happened in that community? Non-for-profits, schools. That's who's renting. In Midtown, I know of one hedge fund. They used to take 10 floors of 666. They've subleased out of their 10 floors. They've subleased 8 of the 10 floors. It's a different world today. So those jobs that we expected, And those jobs that people were accruing, it's over. But yet people want to live in the communities that have the Orthodox tax. That destroys a marriage. What's a tragedy? Remember how we all tell the story. Rav Moshe, we quote Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal. A man came to him broken, crying. He says, you know, this one and this one, when they came to America, so the tefillin got chucked in Ellis Island, and they were Mechal Shabbos. And look at their kids. Their kids became from Balei Tshuva. Me, I was mostly nefesh. I gave up job after job to keep Shabbos. And my kids went off the derech. And he crying to Rav Moshe. So Rav Moshe wasn't going to break him. But Rav Moshe afterwards commented to some of his talmidim, and you'll have to help me with the Yiddish. He says, you know what happened? He says, the other people, they grew up in a happy home. Doesn't mean you're going to turn out religious if you grow up in a happy home, but there's a good chance of it if psychologically you're in a certain place. He says, this, you know what his kids saw at the Shabbos, at every Friday night dinner, at every Shabbos table? Him cressing and his wife cressing and the pain and the disgust over the fact that they couldn't earn a living and they couldn't do this. That mentality of some Schwer zu sein, if that's all the kids see. So you know what? Today we have that on our Shabbos tables. It's called, and this goes back to something Dr. Palkovich said in the last session. When the parents are just, and I see it. And I see it in multiple communities. What do the parents talk about? The burden, the pain, the cost of tuition, of day school tuition. If that's the conversation at the Shabbos table, the kids pick that up. I pick up that Judaism is a burden. Being religious, going to yeshiva is a burden. It's a hassle. And that's a challenge. And by the way, for the most part, that's a challenge we didn't create. I'm not saying that there aren't those who created it that lived above and beyond their means, but for the most part, it's not so. We didn't create that. That's an inherent challenge of living here in the States. And I'll tell you, I used to think that line about, quote-unquote, the centrist or the modern Orthodox, that day school tuition, that is the greatest factor in birth control. I used to think that was a canard. Well, if you look at the statistics, the 2011, and we'll talk about that tonight, the 2011 survey that just came out from the New York Federation, which has the five boroughs plus Westchester and Nassau, and it breaks families up. It has new categories that never existed on Federation surveys before. Hasidish, yeshivish, and modern centrist Orthodox. And you see the birth, you see the reproduction rate. It's the case. Our reproduction rate is not only less than the Hasidic community, it's much less than the Yeshivish community. I don't think it's because, you know, they have a different diet or there's something different in the water. I think a lot of that is a function of the cost of tuition and the lifestyle that we're leading. More than financial stress, more than boundary issues, in-law issues, parental issues, more than sexual issues, and more than religious differences, the two greatest factors. Number two, 22% of the 5,200 surveyed said this was a challenge in their marriage. 22%. And that is the issue of time. T-I-M-E, time. What is that referring to? And here's where I want to start with. There's a great lie, a terrible, horrific lie that has been perpetrated upon Western civilization for the last 50 years. You know what that lie is? Quality time. I travel all over the world. I work like a dog. But don't worry, because once every other Wednesday, I take this child out and we go for a Slurpee or we go to dinner. We have our set time where I shut off my Crackberry or my smartphone, and all I do is focus. Every second week we go out. Quality time. And I have a date night. We have quality time. The therapist will tell you that's a lie. That's a filthy, corrupt lie. There is no substitute for quantity time. There is no substitute for quantity time. You can't have it. The Rosh Kollel from Yeshiva University, Rav Herschel Schechter, he has a fascinating insight. In Mishpatim, when you look at See, Chazal, the rabbis, that's called Masechtah Ksuvos. They embellished and they developed Ishus to a much greater degree. But the minimal responsibility in terms of Ishus that a husband has to one's wife, it's a definition in marriage. And if a husband doesn't fulfill it, it's by definition a court can force a divorce because a husband's not functioning. It's not marriage if he doesn't. So She'era Ksusa V'Onasa. She'er and Ksus, the way we poskin, we follow that opinion in Ksuvos. Referring to certain financial responsibilities, same standard of living they had as a married, as she had as a single woman. Ksus from the word kisui is a clothing budget, a shelter budget. That's why I was very careful before I got married. I wanted to make sure my wife didn't have a Neiman Marcus Platinum card because there was no way I was going to be able to keep up with that. I wanted to fulfill the religious mandates of the ketubah. But what's onasa? So everybody will tell you what's ona. Ona is one fulfilling one's conjugal responsibilities. A meaningful sexual relationship where she can attain fulfillment, etc. That has all of that's embodied in that, the verbal foreplay, the physical foreplay, being there. The Ramban develops that whole mitzvah of ona, the menorah samaor. But there's only one problem. The word ona, ayin vav nun hey. What does it mean? Translate that word. It means time. And that, Chazal, don't you? When they talk about conjugal responsibility, what terms do Chazal use in the Mishnah, in the Tosefta, in the Gemara? Tashmish, bia, right? They use for conjugal responsibilities. Why didn't the Torah use the word tashmish, bia? Those are clean terms. It's not referring. It's not like English. They're euphemistic clean terms. Why does the Torah use the word ona? So the Rosh Kolo said, Rav Schechter said the following: because the basic responsibility is to be there. It may mean that at certain times of the month, that translates into being there in a conjugal way. But the primary responsibility is to be there. To be there, to be committed emotionally. And that we've lost in this generation. My brother is a CFO of a major marketing firm, one of WPP's largest divisions. So he's got operations on 6 continents. And you know what? They need him to, on certain moves. The poor guy, if he wouldn't keep Shabbos, my brother, he'd be working 24/7. Because the Chinese operations, the Argentinian operations, the Indian operations, the British operations, the French operations, the West Coast operations, it never stops. And there are many like him. Believe it or not, even in the OU. We have plants in 82 countries. We're certifying operations in 82 different countries. So our specialists, whether it's the chocolate specialist, the alcohol specialist, the flavoring specialist, whoever it is, they're getting calls from mashgichim and from factories, literally, 24/6. So some of these factories only operate 5 days a week, but some of them not. Certain countries are operating 7 days a week. What's the point? How are you ever there? And we talked about it, just to survive today. In certain industries, physicians are not being reimbursed what they used to be reimbursed. I don't have to talk to this group. Okay? What it requires just to support a family. It's a real problem. It's a real problem. In what Dr. Pelkovitz spoke about earlier this morning, when we're home, we're really not home. Because we're on call. This guy, this little guy here. Right, we're on call all the time. People expect you to respond to that email, expect you to respond to that text. I'm going to say something now that's not scientific, nor is it from a survey. Okay? So you can take it or leave it, and you can push back on this. I believe as a generalization, and it's a generalization, not a truism, that our grandparents and great-grandparents had much better marriages than we do. And I know it sounds counterintuitive, because our understanding of psychological condition of the human being, of the emotional makeup of the human being. Whether or not we have PhDs in psychology, whether or not we have degrees as psychiatrists, just reading a Wall Street Journal, a New York Times, just hearing what we hear, being exposed to what we're exposed to, the kind of people that we meet in mental health, we have a much more nuanced, sophisticated understanding than they ever had. But their marriages, I would say, were much better than our marriages, as a generalization. And you know what I think the difference is? It goes back to this issue. first of all, no matter how hard they worked, they weren't dealing with markets that were operating 24 hours. They may have worked very hard physically, but they ate dinner together. You hear about the value. Dr. Pelkovitz, others always tell us about the value of what it means for a family to sit down to eat dinner together. And they weren't distracted. They didn't have, you know, Dish TV and what's it called, Direct TV with 500 channels. They had three for stunking the channels that were worthless, and they went off the air after the 11 o'clock news. They actually spent more time with each other. They traveled much less for business than we do. They were there for each other. Quantity, not just quality time. And that's an issue. That's an issue, believe it or not, that was rated much more significant than financial stress. And that's an issue that, believe it or not, was much more significant than outlaws, in-laws. It's interesting. Rav Melech Schechter, that's the father of Rav Herschel Schechter. He was a Rav in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And there were a few people. There was Rav Nata Greenblatt, who, thank God, is still alive, a Talmud Rav Moshe in Memphis. He's in his late 80s. Rav Schechter. They were specialists in Gittin. And literally, they would go all across the country. It's just to give you an analogy. A GI should not be doing neurosurgery, correct? You go to a special neurosurgeon for that purpose. So too, a typical rabbi cannot oversee, cannot be misader gerushin. That's not something that we're trained or that we're an authority in. And if, God forbid, this is a very nuanced, subtle aspect of the rabbinate. If we make a mistake, you're dealing with mamzerus. So you bring in specialists like a Rav Melech Schechter, you bring in a specialist like a Rav Nata Greenblatt. So he said to me once, and he said, look, it's anecdotal. You know, we used to sit, we were brought in, we were obviously not doing therapy, but I used to ask the husband, ask the wife, you know, what were the factors that led? And remember, divorce was not as common 30 and 40 and 50 years ago when he was a Masada Gerushin. And he said anecdotally, the two issues that he felt were our issues 3 and 4. Was that lack of boundaries? Was the tension between parents or in-laws in the couple? Not being able to cut the cord. Very often it's the male who can't cut the cord, more so than the female. And then he said the other issue was financial issues. But today, what are we seeing? There are two issues that trump the financial and that trump the lack of boundary. The first you said was time. And number one, more than time, more than financial stress, more than boundary issues, more than sexual issues, and more than religious differences. The number one issue, 23% of those surveyed, was communication challenges, issues in communication. And what was really fascinating here is the issues that were written in on the subjective component from the women were very different than that which was written in from the men. Meaning what? The women, see, when you look at the different mammals, there's a difference between Homo sapien and, let's say, the bovine species, or Homo sapien and dolphins or orangutans. But one area that there was a great, great commonality was the male communication skills. Men grunt. They're not that different than bulls or than horses. In other words, on an average day, you get a yes, a no, a maybe. On your anniversary or on a birthday, you might get a phrase, or even if you got a good husband, you might get a full sentence. But don't ever expect a full paragraph. Women complained that my husband is not emotionally effusive, doesn't communicate. And guess what? The men wrote in and complained the following, just the opposite. I ask a simple question and I get a PhD thesis. What women don't realize, that there's certain anatomical differences between the male and female gender. I don't know if women realize this, that every man is created with an on-off switch. There's a little button behind his ear, you know. She's going on communicating. He shut her down 4 sentences ago. Hasn't heard a word since. He's looking at her, hasn't heard a word since. But this is a real disconnect here. And I'm going to borrow something. One of my peers, my coworkers, is my predecessor in my position. You've heard of Rabbi Weinrib, Heshi Weinrib. So Heshi told me this. He said the following. He says, from a psychological point of view, you have all these different marriage books. The psychologists say it's not the best book out there. But many recommend this book for the following reason. Because what's the purpose of reading a book? You take it with you. There's what you've read, you internalize, and you take with you. What's the purpose of hearing a lecture? It's something that hopefully you can walk away. Like Dr. Palkovitz always develops the theory, and then he gives you an example, a story, he gives you a Mamar Chazal, and you can walk away with it and take something. And so he said, that's why, Heschel was saying, Rabbi Weinberg was saying, that's why many people recommend this book. Next to the Gemara, next to the Rambam, the Tanakh, is John Gray's Men Are From Mars, Women From Venus. Now, that's what we named this talk. What does he say? He's got a very interesting chapter in the book. It's called Mr. Fix-It. And that reflects upon this issue, the communication issue. What's Mr. Fix-It? Men, as a rule, as a generalization, think in rational, logical, analytical terms. Right? That's why, to a certain degree, we do fairly well studying Gemara, going to law school. We think in these linear analytical terms. What happens? Rabbi Kelman was saying that we moved from Beverly Hills to Teaneck a couple of years ago to take the OU job. So I'm going to go back to my California years. In Hollywood, we have, imagine this scene, okay? He comes in. He's had a rough day. It hasn't been easy. But he looks at her, and she's, yeah, that could be Mount St. Helens. He's about to explode. Must be my mother, huh? Well, he says, honey, what's the matter? And then she just starts to unload. And what does he do? He's listening attentively. He's analytical. After she stops, he goes into what John Gray refers to as Mr. Fix-It mode. That's the chapter, Mr. Fix-It. What does Mr. Fix-It do? He's going to sit, and he's going to, one by one, go through all these problems that she's just dumped on him. And he thinks he's such a tzaddik, because after all, he's had a rough day. And he's solving her problems and telling her what to do and how to say to this one and how to deal with that one. And then in the middle of this, she explodes. Will you just be quiet, please? It just explodes on him. He doesn't understand why, even though they've been through this 12 times in the last 2 years, but he doesn't remember that. Because what did she want? She wanted a hug. She wanted him with his body to demonstrate empathy. She wanted him just to listen. She's got an IQ that's 20 points higher than him. If she needed somebody to solve her problems, that's not the guy she's going to. She can do that on her own. You know? She just wanted him to listen and to empathize and to demonstrate that he cares. So, go back to Hollywood. You know what we say in Hollywood? Take two. When he came in that door and he sees Mount St. Helens ready to erupt, what? She thinks because she's gone through this 12 times in the past, he's going to remember and figure it out? No. We don't work that way. She should have said to him, honey, I know you. You're going to want to solve my problems. Don't do it. Just listen. Look like you care. Demonstrate body language. Give me a hug. Just listen. I just want to unload. If she had said that to him, she wouldn't have been disappointed. Because he would have known. His job is to try to show a little emotion. His job is to try to be there. But men don't naturally do that. And that's one simple example that John Gray gives. But that's true across the board. You got to realize, that's true across the board. We just don't communicate well. Okay? And this issue, built upon the issue of time, it's built upon the issue of financial stress, but I think it transcends that, because even if you could isolate it away from financial stress and not being there, communication is a real issue. It's a real issue. And this was a challenge. I'm going to say something before we conclude this part of the discussion. There's a fascinating piece from the Vilna Gaon. Vilna Gaon asks a question that bothers all of us. You and I know the methodology of our Chazal, the Chachmei HaMesorah, was always a conservation of terms. You know, it was always a synergy of energy and scale. So I'll give you an example. In a bracha, if you could say it in three words, you wouldn't use four. In formulating a tefillah, in formulating a bracha. There seems to be one violation to this principle, and it's true across the board, whether it's Birkas HaMitzvos, Birkas HaShevach, Birkas HaHoda'ah, Birkas HaNanim, those very short. So you get to what? The seventh, the ultimate Sheva Bracha. And we don't know what to deal with. We're lost. 10 synonyms? So what do we do, Nebuch? What do? We turn it into a song. So the Miami Boys Choir has their version, and this one has their version, and we sing this bracha. You know, Nebuch, because we have nothing else to do with it, because it's 10 synonyms, so we make it into songs. Okay? What were Chazal doing? Sason the Simcha, Gila, Rina, Ditza the Chedva, Ava, the Achva, the Shalom the Reus. What were they doing? You know, Chazal are not Hemingway. They're not Chaucer. They're not Shakespeare. What were they doing with 10 synonyms there? So the Gaon says the following. He says, what is that bracha? It's a petition to the Almighty. You have a couple that start embarking upon the rest of their life together. So at the beginning, at that wedding, you know, she has a beautiful wedding dress. You know, and she's going to have four outfits for the Sheva Bracha. So you've got two new suits, you know, she's got a new sheitel, you name it, and they've got a live band, and then there's a smorgasbord, and there's a four-course meal, and this one's making, you know. That's the Sason V'Simcha, that's tangible, concrete joy. But as this marriage evolves, as this marriage transcends that level, it will go from the realm of the tangible, the realm of the concrete, into much more subtle and sublime forms. And there are different stages. And it's a bracha, it's a petition, it's a tefillah more than a, it's a tefillah. That what? That this sasan and simcha that everyone's so excited about, and we're all so happy, and we're dancing and singing together, it will turn into, and I want to skip to the last four stages, because they're the most sublime and the most subtle. Ava, achva, Shalom v'Reus. What are those four terms? So we know Ava, the shoresh of that word is Hey Bet. Hey Beis. What is it? Hav. It's giving. It's the nature of that relationship is, what can I do for my spouse? In other words, it's not about being self-centered. It's not the ani, but it's about giving in sensitivity to the other. That's Ava. What's Achva? Kinship, brotherhood. Well, you know, it's interesting because there's only one relationship we have in our life that really knows us. Our parents, if it's olam kiminhago, our parents will leave us, you know, maybe 20, 30, 40 years before we leave this earth. Our children come into our lives 20, 30, 40 years after we've come to this earth. There's only one relationship that we have a relationship with from in every stage of our life, from infancy through the last years on this earth. That's a sibling. That we have that relationship with a sibling in every decade of our life. They know us. What do we say? This couple should really develop a relationship where they come to know each other and relate to each other, that they have that intimate understanding of each other the way a sibling would. Ah, but there's a kinship there. What's shalom? The shorish of shalom is shalem. That hopefully this couple will make each other whole and complete. We all have dysfunctionalities. Dr. Pelkovitz, I use a term similar to what Dr. Pelkovitz was saying in the last session. You know, anyone who claims to be normal, stay far away from that family. Stay far away from that person. If they think they're normal, watch out. Okay? Let's be honest. We're amongst friends here. We're spending the weekend up here in Lake Placid. We're all dysfunctional. Every family is, every individual. You know what I'd say about our family? We try to put the fun in dysfunctional. You know, that's the point. But so what's the point? No person is complete. No person is whole, complete. We all have insecurities. We all have challenges. We all have, you know, black spots, so to speak, where we can't see the light. Hopefully we make each other. Oh, and by the way, that doesn't happen in 2 years of marriage, and it doesn't happen in 6 years of marriage. That's an avoda. Avoda kasha shebemikdash. That's something that takes decades of working at. Where we complement each other, we complete each other, we make each other whole. Ava v'achva shalom, and what's the best? The highest level? Reyut. Reyut is what? That we become best of friends. How many of us, we see people. They're married to someone. But when they really need to pour out their heart, they go to this friend or that friend. When they really need, you know, just to open up, or they don't necessarily go to their spouse. And I remember I was talking about this Gon with, used to live, as Rabbi Kalman mentioned, in Michigan. So we have Rosh Kollel there, Moshe Schwab. And I was a young rabbi, you know, came there wet behind the ears, you know. I would share with him sometimes issues that I was confronted with. I always would send to a therapist, but, you know, I was a supplement to a therapist. Not that I did therapy, but just to be a listener, to be a support system to a couple going through tough times. And I would share with him. He says, you got to realize, he says, if you take this Gon to heart, he says, most marriages do not attain Ava v'Achva v'Shalom v'Reyus. They attain certain levels. You know, he's going to pay the bills, and she's going to take care of this, and he's going to do that. And it's, they're not going to end up in divorce, that marriage. It's going to function, but it's going to be a practical, utilitarian marriage. That it will be a sublime, transcendent marriage? That doesn't happen with all marriages. And the bracha that we make when this marriage starts out under that chuppah, the first week of Sheva brachas, is that the sason and simcha they're experiencing through decades of work, of time, of true communication, through decades of proper boundaries, through decades of proper intimacy, through decades of working together, not going apart where there's religious differences, that ultimately is what? That ultimately, our bracha, our tefillah, I should say, keep using the wrong term, our tefillah, is that it should attain Ava v'Achva v'Shalom v'Reyus. What this survey, done over 3 years, says about us, the contemporary Jewish world, Hasidish, Yeshivish, Modernish, Bali Tshuva, from birth, what it says is this. It says two things. The good news is that we are way off the scale in terms of the quality of our marriages, the substance and the quality, positive quality of our marriages, relative to greater society, it's much better than society at large. But we got to be honest. 80% said they would do it all over again. That's a great number. Maybe we'd like to see a higher number, 95, 99. 72 and 74 said, you know, very good or excellent. You know, we'd like to see in the 90s. That's the challenge. These are not simple issues. They're not simple issues because a lot of these issues, we say in Yiddish, was is Christelzach is Yiddelzach. A lot of these issues are superimposed via osmosis by the society that we live in. But with it all being said and done, with all the challenges we have in a very challenging financial environment and a very challenging society, with it all being said and done, the reality is we have a lot to build upon. And things are not all that bad. God willing, you know, as we educate our children, as we work hard at our own marriages and develop it, it will go from even good to great. It will get even better. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, Bakasha. Avi Libman, who Bezrat Hashem is getting married in 26 days.
That's,
so God wish him.
Oh, boy. You got 200 of you.
What advice can you offer at Hassan of getting married in 26 days? The last part, brother. I wrote down that whole thing.
I would talk to Dr. Pelkovich. Remember one thing. What I said, I meant. We are dysfunctional. We put the fun in dysfunctional. I'm not sure you want to. No, I'm just joking. I would ask Dr. Pelkovich. Dr. Pelkovich, you could speak.
The colors in the other room.
Okay. Two thoughts. Bouncing off that wonderful talk. One is after the initial excitement to figure out a way to turn towards. Let me tell you what I mean by that. This guy, John Mordechai Gottman, who, if you want to read one book that is the most universally respected book, research-based book on marriage, it's by a guy named John Mordechai Gottman. He's has over 400 peer-reviewed articles and goes lecturing around the world with a big yarmulke on his head. We brought him into YU a couple of times, for a couple of days, I mean, to speak to rabbis and some of the smicha students. And he does very interesting research. His research is that that you need to figure out how to maintain the shared vision and dream. Meaning that early on, right now in your stage, you know, you're on the same page, you've decided to spend your lives together, and you have a shared vision and dream, like Rabbi Wall was saying, how do you see how do you see your Shabbos table looking like? You know, how do you want to throw yourself into your day-to-day life and into the institutions that you see sending your children to, etc., down the road? But where it gets challenging is the day-to-day stuff. You know, this is matos mase, the travels over time. And what tends to happen as the time factor being so high up in the survey shows is that it gets harder to do that unless you're mindful about it. What Gottman shows is the couples that get themselves in trouble, as opposed to couples that do well, is the couples that do well, they learn to turn towards, meaning that it becomes very easy to do what Rabbi Wall was talking about, sort of to shut off, to have that off switch, and to lose sight of each other's individual vision and dreams. And there needs to be a conscious way of overriding that. When you make it into a goal and you make it you're mindful about it in terms of, like, you know, your wife's talking to you about something and you're reading the paper, or you're preoccupied with something, to say, no, there's nothing more important than this, to turn towards each other and to make that time. It's that component that may seem like it's not that important, but it's extremely important. The other thing in terms of communication is just to remember the three words of Sefer HaSidim, Achris Ketata Charata, meaning that, you know, after argument there's always regret, and to figure out how to always strike when the iron is cold. There's inevitable places. I know I'm probably panicking you out with some of this because I'm not focusing on the positive. So the need to pull back. I'll just tell you something. All the research shows that the Gemara's wisdom of Tabla Mesav Tandu Mila Mesav Armalu, much better in terms of marriage being associated with all kinds of enduring wonderful stuff. The Orthodox Jewish marriage, the higher level of happiness, is 15 percentage points higher than in the general population. So there's something about everything from Taras HaMishpacha to everything else that we do. And I realize a lot of the advice that I normally give probably is going to sound more negative than positive. But on the positive end, it's just to bottle what you have now and figure out how to keep it going over the long run. Nothing more important than that time component. And if you keep your eye on the ball in terms of doing that, you know, what you have to look forward to is that you have a way of life that makes it significantly more likely that you're going to have wonderful, incredibly happy life together, as long as you just keep your eye on the ball in terms of that. Now, that sounded, I didn't like my answer, but it's all that came, that could come to mind for now. And Mazel Tov.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll take about a 20-minute break. There are refreshments down the hall. In this room, genetics will be. We'll do our genetics one in this room. And okay, we'll see in 20 minutes. And the palliative care, obviously, is the next door. Okay, thank you.